Howard's rigidity impeded him from doing his job, which was to legislate. He would lose these votes in the House, maybe 412-3. My dad would be among the three. And it just didn't get to him. He was very much at peace. It would have gotten to me. I get mad when I lose. I can't ever recall seeing him depressed or despondent. He just figured he was doing the best he could. He went his own way, and he knew why he was there, for us kids. He had a very pessimistic appraisal of where the country was going, but he was not a pessimist. The way Howard invariably held aloft his principles, instead of working toward Republican Party goals by joining coalitions, strained relationships with his colleagues and took a toll on the family. Lila cared about fitting in. Other people's opinions mattered to her. She was also competitive. "Why can't you be a little more flexible?" she said. "Like Ken Wary," the junior Nebraska senator who was moving quickly up the ranks. Howard was having none of it. "We believed in him," says Doris, "but it was hard to see him lose all the time." That was an understatement. All the Buffetts admired Howard's fortitude and credit their father for teaching them integrity, but each of the children absorbed in their own way a desire to belong that somehow muted or balanced the family streak of independence. Her husband's stance as the lone wolf of the party exacerbated Lila's irritable mood. Still miserable about living in Washington, she tried to create a miniature Omaha and spent her free time with the women of the Nebraska delegation. But that free time was limited, for she no longer had a cleaning lady. She felt put upon. "I gave it all up to marry Howard," she would say, adding this lament to her stories of how she and Howard had sacrificed for their ungrateful children's welfare. But rather than teaching those children to help around the house, she did everything, because it was just easier to do it myself. Feelings of martyrdom made her angry at the kids a lot of the time, especially at Doris, who was having her own issues about fitting in. Although strikingly pretty, Doris says she never felt that way and was insecure about whether she was good enough for the sophisticated Washington crowd of which she longed to be a part. She was invited to the French embassy for Margaret Truman's birthday party and was added to the debutante register as she began planning to debut as a Princess of Exarban, Nebraska spelled backward, with the crowd she would have been graduating with back in Omaha. Warren made fun of her for her pretensions. Lila, herself a determined striver who cared deeply about appearances, would pore over every bit of news about the Duchess of Windsor, a penniless commoner who had been rescued by a prince. But unlike the Duchess, who spent the rest of her life amassing one of the world's most impressive collections of jewels, Lila's ambition and pride wrapped themselves in a self-conscious disdain for ostentation. She pictured the family as a middle-class Midwestern archetype, a Saturday Evening Post magazine cover, and berated Doris for being socially ambitious. Still 14 years old, Warren became a sophomore at Woodrow Wilson High School in February 1945, upon his graduation from Alice Deal. He wanted to be both special and normal at the same time. Much less mature than his classmates, he was being carefully watched by his parents, who were determined to see him straighten out. His paper routes were the source of his autonomy, such autonomy as he now had, and he had been reading as well as throwing the papers. "I read the comics, the sports section, and looked at the stock pages every morning before I delivered the newspapers. I read the cartoon Lil Abner every morning. I had to know what Lil Abner was doing every day." His appeal was that he made you feel so smart. You'd read this thing and think, "If I was in that position, this guy is so dumb." Because here was Daisy May, this incredible woman who was just nuts about him and was always chasing after him, and he just kept passing her up and not noticing her. Every red-blooded American boy in those days would have been just waiting there for Daisy May to catch him. Daisy May Scragg, the hillbilly heroine of the Appalachian cartoon hamlet of Dogpatch, was a bodacious blonde whose cleavage burst from an off-the-shoulder polka-dot blouse. The dim-witted strongman Lil Abner Yoakum spent most of his time trying to evade Daisy May's marital designs on him, but the faster he ran away, the more deaf he seemed to her attention and longing, the more he spurned her, the harder Daisy May chased him. Even though rich and powerful men wooed her, to Daisy May there was but one man on earth, Lil Abner. Besides elusiveness, Lil Abner's only apparent asset was his manly physique. Warren's poor record with girls so far suggested that if he ever wanted to attract the interest of a girl like Daisy May, he had better do something to make himself more attractive. Now he developed a new interest, which conveniently gave him an excuse as well for hiding away down in the basement. The way that Frankie Zick could clean and jerk 50-pound bags of animal feed for hours at a time at South Omaha Feed had impressed him. He got his friend Lou Battistone interested, and they embarked on a weightlifting program. At the time, weight training was not the stuff of serious athletes, but it had many qualities that appealed to Warren. Systems, measuring, counting, repetition, and competing with yourself. In search of technique, he had discovered Bob Hoffman and his magazine, Strength and Health. Strength and Health was Hoffman's attempt to overcome the stigma against weightlifting through aggressive promotion. It was edited, published, and apparently written largely by Hoffman himself. Ads for his products appeared on nearly every page. Uncle Bob's technical knowledge, his razzle-dazzle, the man's unflagging ability to market himself, were striking. He was the coach of most of the Olympic team. He was the head of the York Barbell Company, and he was the author of the Big Arms and the Big Chest books. The basic thing he sold initially was barbell sets. If you went to a sporting goods store then, everything was York barbells. You could buy all these different kinds of sets. Warren got a set of dumbbells and a barbell with a set of plates in increments of 1¼ pounds that slipped on and off the bar, which he tightened with a little screwdriver that came with the set. He kept the weights in the basement and was always down there clanking. My parents got a big kick out of the whole thing. Sometimes he went down to the YMCA to lift weights among other young men. He and Lou took their hobby seriously, making insider jokes about the heavy and light lifting system and upright rowing motions. They paid close attention to everything Uncle Bob wrote. Hoffman knew how to adapt to the tenor of the times. Everyone knew about the vicious Jap soldier's ability to withstand pain and suffering, so he wrote that the point of lifting weights was to fight the Japanese. He illustrated this with a photo of a vicious Jap soldier, arched in a backbend from his toes to the crown of his head, lifting a huge set of cement barbells over his chest, training to beat the Allies. Warren was not lifting weights to fight the Japanese, or, for that matter, to fight anybody. Everything that Uncle Bob wrote, however, inspired him in his competition with himself. But while Warren was clanking down in the basement, the Republicans were in hell. Franklin Roosevelt had managed to win a fourth term as president, ensuring the Democrats another 4 years in the White House. At the dinner table, the family listened to much ranting from Howard. Then, on April 12th, Roosevelt died of a cerebral hemorrhage, and his vice president, Harry Truman, succeeded him as president. Roosevelt's death sent most of the country into deep mourning, tinged with fear. 3½ years into the war, the country had lost the man who made it feel secure, and it had low expectations of Truman. He retained FDR's cabinet and sounded so humble that some thought he might be overwhelmed by the job. But to the Buffetts, no one could be worse than FDR. The family down the street, whose father worked for the Canadian embassy, came to call on their congressman neighbor upon the president's death and pay their condolences. But when they arrived, Doris says, "Yo-ho-ho, we were celebrating." And to Warren, the death of a president meant another way to make money. Newspapers put out special editions, and he hustled himself out to the street corner, hawking papers while everybody mourned. 1 month later, on May 8, 1945, came VE Day, the formal end of the war in Europe following Germany's unconditional surrender. Again, there were special editions to sell, and Warren echoed his father's political convictions as a matter of course. But at the time, he was only passingly interested in these adult concerns, because his real obsession was weightlifting and Bob Hoffman. He spent most of his free time down in the basement. A few weeks later, when school was out, he could wait no longer. He had to meet his idol, Uncle Bob. He was it. I had to see him in person. With their parents' amused blessing, Warren and Lou took off for York, Pennsylvania, hitchhiking part of the way. He had this barbell factory up there in York where they turned this stuff out. It was really more of a foundry, and he had the whole Olympic team working there. John Grimmick was the big bodybuilder. Steve Stanko held the world's record then for the clean and jerk, 381 pounds. But this is before they had super heavyweight classifications. In one sense, the visit was demoralizing. The guys did not bulk up the same way in those days. It blew my mind that here were these guys that were Olympic champions, but a lot of them were small because they were in smaller weight classes. And if you saw them in a foundry, wearing foundry-type clothes, they just looked like nothing. But in another sense, the sight of those fairly ordinary-looking men lifted the boys' aspirations. Maybe success in bodybuilding was within their reach. They saw themselves becoming men, physical specimens who could impress a woman. Uncle Bob, when he spoke, it was like God was talking to us. And when you looked at yourself in the mirror, you saw deltoids and abs and the latissimus dorsi and everything. You learned every muscle group. But the most impressive celebrity in strength and health, apart from Uncle Bob himself, was not John Grimmick, the greatest bodybuilder in the world. It was a woman. There were not a lot of women in strength and health. Pudgy Stockton's about the only one that ever made it. I liked Pudgy. She was impressive. We talked about her a lot at school. That was more than a slight understatement. Warren and Lou were obsessed with Abby Pudgy Stockton, a work of art in human flesh, taut thighs rippling as her chiseled arms lofted a huge barbell above her wind-whipped hair, bikini showing off her tiny waist and perky bosom to all the muscle men and gaping onlookers at Santa Monica's Muscle Beach. 5'1" and 115 pounds, she could lift a grown man in the air over her head and do it without sacrificing any of her femininity. As the world's foremost female physical culturist, she wrote Barbells, a column in Strength and Health, and conducted a salon of figure development, specializing in bust development, figure contouring, and reducing in Los Angeles. She had the muscle tone of Mitzi Gaynor and the mammary development of Sophia Loren, says Lou Battistone. She was phenomenal, and we, I have to admit to you, we lusted for her. Until now, Daisy May had been Warren's fantasy girl. He would always look for the qualities of Daisy May in a woman. But Pudgy was real. It was not clear, however, exactly what you did if you had a girlfriend like Pudgy. The boys puzzled over ads for Bob Hoffman's Guide to a Successful Happy Marriage, which featured premarital examination, how to examine your wife before marriage to make sure she's intact, as well as courtship, why people marry, and minor forms of lovemaking. Just what were the minor forms of lovemaking, they wondered. Even the major forms were largely a mystery to them. The ads in the back of Strength and Health were the best the 1940s could do in terms of sex education. Don't worry, Dad, we're down in the basement, doing a little studying for our physics exam. However, in the end, Warren's fascination with numbers won out. You know, you kept measuring that biceps to see if it had gone from 13 to 13 and a quarter inches, and you were always worried whether you were loosening up the tape or anything. But I never improved from looking like the Charles Atlas before picture. I think my biceps went from 13 inches to 13 and a quarter inches after thousands of curls. The Big Arms book didn't do me much good. Chapter 12. Silent Sales. Washington, D.C., 1945 to 1947. That August, while the Buffetts were back in Omaha, the United States dropped two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On September 2nd, Japan formally surrendered. The war was over. Americans celebrated in near hysteria, but Warren recalls that he quickly started thinking through the next chess moves after the dropping of the bombs. I didn't know anything about physics, but I knew you could kill a couple of 100,000 people if you were the first one to use the bomb in a war. It's as if I run into some guy in a dark alley, and I've got a cannon, but he's got a gun. If he's willing to pull the trigger, and I have some moral compunction against doing it, he wins. Einstein said right away, This has changed everything in the world except how men think. It put a fuse to the end of the world. Now it may be a long fuse, and there may be ways to interrupt it, but once that metaphorical bomb has a dozen fuses all burning, the problem becomes a different sort of thing than if no fuse is lit. I was only 14, but it seemed to me just totally clear what was going to happen, and it has happened to quite a degree. A few weeks later, with the family back in Washington, Warren returned to finish 10th grade at Woodrow Wilson High School. At 15, still a kid, but now also a businessman. He was making so much money throwing papers that he had accumulated more than $2,000. Howard had let his son invest in Builder's Supply Company, a hardware store that he and Carl Falk were opening next to the feed store back in Omaha. Meanwhile, Warren himself had bought a 40-acre farm for $1,200, about 70 miles away, near Walt Hill in Thurston County, Nebraska. A tenant farmer worked the farm, and they shared the profits, just the kind of arrangement Warren liked, with someone else doing the sweaty, boring work. Warren began introducing himself to people in high school as Warren Buffett from Nebraska, who owned a tenant farm back in the Midwest. He thought like a businessman, but did not look like one. He fit uncomfortably into the high school crowd, showing up with the same tattered sneakers and droopy socks peeking out from under baggy trousers day after day, skinny neck and narrow shoulders swallowed inside his shirt. If forced into dress shoes, he wore startling yellow or white socks above the scuffed leather. He seemed to squirm in his seat all the time. Sometimes he looked shy, almost innocent. At others, he wore a sharp, tough expression. Doris and Warren ignored each other if their paths crossed in the halls of high school. Doris, who was very popular, was particularly ashamed of me because I dressed terribly. Sometimes your sister would help you get socialized, but I rejected that, basically. It wasn't her fault. I was painfully aware of being socially maladjusted. I may just have felt so hopeless. Warren's stone-faced, smart-aleck act covered up the feelings of inadequacy that had made his life so difficult since leaving Omaha. He desperately wanted to be normal, but still felt very much the outsider. He was hesitant, said classmate Norma Thurston, his friend Don Danley's girlfriend, and he chose his words carefully and never made any commitment, however small, if he thought he might have to take it back. Many of his classmates plunged enthusiastically into teenage life, joining fraternities and sororities, getting pinned, and going to parties in their families' basements where they served soda pop, hot dogs, and ice cream, and then turned the lights down while everybody necked. Instead of necking, Warren rubbernecked. He had a regular Saturday night reservation with Lou Battistone at Jimmy Lake's Theater, a local burlesque joint, where they had a fantasy flirtation with one of the dancers, Kitty Lynn. Warren would roar with laughter when a comedian took a pratfall, or the second banana in the balcony started heckling him. He spent $25 on a 1920s-style raccoon coat. When he wore it down to Jimmy Lake's, the bouncer told him, "No clowning around, you guys. Either take that coat off or you can't come in." He took it off. The side of Warren that had robbed Sears blind was in transition, fading, but not gone. He and Danley still took the occasional five-finger discount at Sears. When his teachers told him they had most of their retirement savings in AT&T stock, he shorted it, then showed them the trade tickets to give them heartburn. "I was a pain in the ass," he says. His exceptional powers of reasoning and smart-aleck tendencies combined into a talent for taking perverse stands. Somehow, probably because he was the son of a congressman, he wound up appearing on a radio program on January 3, 1946. CBS American School of the Air brought its program to WTOP, the local station owned by the Washington Post. On that Saturday morning, Warren went down to the station, where he and four other kids sat around a microphone and debated as Congress in session. The show's hostess assigned him the job of spicing up the debate. He argued convincingly in favor of absurdities, ideas on the order of eliminating income taxes or annexing Japan. "When they wanted someone to take a crazy position," he says, "I did it." But while he relished argument for its own sake, His clever retorts, lightning-fast counterarguments, and general contrariness hindered his quest to be liked by his peers. Until now, Warren's efforts to get along with people had had mixed results. He charmed adults, except for his teachers. He felt ill at ease with his peers, but had always managed to make a few close friends. He desperately wanted people to like him, and especially not to attack him personally. He wanted a system. In fact, he already had one, but he wasn't using the system to its full effect. Now, lacking any other resources, he began to work harder at it. Warren had found this system at his grandfather's house, where he read everything he could get his hands on at a blazing pace, just as he did at home. Browsing the bookshelf in the back bedroom, he had consumed every issue of The Progressive Grocer and every single copy of the Daily Nebraskan that had been edited by his father, and worked his way like a boll weevil through all 15 years of the Reader's Digest that Ernest had accumulated. This bookcase also held a series of small biographies, many of them on business leaders. Since a young age, Warren had studied the lives of men like Jay Cook, Daniel Drew, Jim Fisk, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jay Gould, John D. Rockefeller, and Andrew Carnegie. Some of these books he read and reread. One of them was special. Not a biography, but a paperback written by former salesman Dale Carnegie, enticingly titled, How to Win Friends and Influence People. He had discovered it at age 8 or 9. Warren knew he needed to win friends, and he wanted to influence people. He opened the book. It hooked him from the first page. If you want to gather honey, it began, don't kick over the beehive. Criticism is futile, said Carnegie. Rule number 1, don't criticize, condemn, or complain. This idea riveted Warren. Criticism was something he knew everything about. Criticism puts people on the defensive, Carnegie said, and makes them strive to justify themselves. It is dangerous because it wounds people's precious pride, hurts their sense of importance, and arouses resentment. Carnegie advocated avoiding confrontation. People don't want criticism. They want honest and sincere appreciation. I am not talking about flattery, Carnegie said. Flattery is insincere and selfish. Appreciation is sincere and comes from the heart. The deepest urge in human nature is the desire to be important. Although don't criticize was the most important, there were 30 rules in all. Everybody wants attention and admiration. Nobody wants to be criticized. The sweetest sound in the English language is the sound of a person's own name. The only way to get the best of an argument is to avoid it. If you are wrong, admit it quickly and emphatically. Ask questions instead of giving direct orders. Give the other person a fine reputation to live up to. Call attention to people's mistakes indirectly. Let the other person save face. I am talking about a new way of life, Carnegie said. I am talking about a new way of life. Warren's heart lifted. He thought he had found the truth. This was a system. He felt so disadvantaged socially that he needed a system to sell himself to people, a system he could learn once and use without having to respond in a new way to each changing situation. But it took numbers to prove that it actually worked. He decided to do a statistical analysis of what happened if he did follow Dale Carnegie's rules, and what happened if he didn't. He tried giving attention and appreciation, and he tried doing nothing or being disagreeable. People around him did not know he was performing experiments on them in the silence of his own head, but he watched how they responded. He kept track of his results. Filled with a rising joy, he saw what the numbers proved. The rules worked. Now he had a system. He had a set of rules. But it did you no good to read about the rules. You had to live them. I am talking about a new way of life, said Carnegie. Warren began to practice. He started at a very elementary level. Some of it came naturally to him, but he found that this system could not be applied in an automatic and easy manner. Don't criticize sounded simple, but there were ways to criticize without even realizing it. It was hard not to show off, not to display annoyance and impatience, and admitting you were wrong was easy sometimes and very difficult at other times. Giving people attention and sincere appreciation and admiration was one of the hardest. Someone sunk in misery much of the time, as Warren was, found it hard to focus on others, not himself. Nevertheless, he gradually worked out for himself that the dark years of junior high were living proof that ignoring Dale Carnegie's rules didn't work. As he started to gain his footing in high school, he continued to practice the rules in encounters with others. Unlike most people who read Carnegie's book and thought, gee, that makes sense, then set the book aside and forgot about it, Warren worked at this project with unusual concentration. He kept coming back to these ideas and using them. Even when he failed and forgot and went for long stretches without applying himself to the system, he returned and resumed practicing in the end. By high school, he had accumulated a few more friends, joined the Woodrow Wilson golf team, and managed to make himself inoffensive, if not popular. Dale Carnegie had honed his natural wit. Above all, it enhanced his persuasiveness, his flair for salesmanship. He seemed intense, yet with an impish side, even-tempered and congenial, yet somehow solitary. Certainly his passion for making money, which occupied most of his spare time, made him unique at Woodrow Wilson. No one else in high school was a businessman. Just from pitching newspapers a couple of hours a day, he was earning $175 a month, more money than his teachers. In 1946, a grown man felt well paid if he made $3,000 a year for full-time work. Warren kept his money in a chiffon robe at home, which no one but he was allowed to touch. "I was in his house one day," says Lou Battistone, "and he opened up a drawer and said, 'This is what I've been saving.' And he had $700 in small bills. That's a big stack, let me tell you." He had started several new businesses. Buffett's Golf Balls peddled refurbished golf balls for $6 a dozen. These he ordered from a fellow in Chicago named Wittek, whom Warren couldn't resist nicknaming Half Wittek. They were classy balls, really good golf balls, too. Titleist and Spalding Dots and Max Flies, which I bought for $3.50 a dozen. They looked brand new. He probably got them the way we first tried to get them, out of water traps, only he was better. Nobody at school knew about Half Wittek. Even his family didn't seem to realize that he bought the used golf balls that he and his friend Don Danley were selling. Fellow members of the Wilson golf team thought he fished them out of water traps. Buffett's Approval Service sold sets of collectible stamps to collectors out of state. Buffett's Showroom Shine was a car buffing business that he and Battistone ran out of Lou's father's used car lot until they abandoned this because it involved manual labor and turned out to be too damn much work. Then one day, when Warren was 17 and a senior, he raced to tell Don Danley about a new idea. It had the same exponential quality to it as the weighing machines from 1,000 Ways to Make $1,000, where one machine could pay for another and another. "I bought this old pinball machine for $25, he said, "and we can have a partnership. Your part of the deal is to fix it up. And look it, we'll tell Frank Errico, the barber, we represent Wilson's coin-operated machine company, and we have a proposition for Mr. Wilson. It's at no risk to you. Let's put this nickel machine in the back, Mr. Errico, and your customers can play while they wait, and we'll split the money." Danley was game. Although no one had ever put pinball machines in barbershops before, they presented their proposition to Mr. Errico, who bit. The boys took the legs off the pinball machine, put it in Don's father's car, and hauled it over to Mr. Errico's barbershop, where they installed it. Sure enough, the very first evening, when Warren and Don came back to check, "Gee, zip," Warren said. $4 worth of nickels had found their way into the machine. Mr. Errico was delighted, and the pinball machine stayed. After a week, Warren emptied the machine and scooped the nickels into two piles. "Mr. Errico," he said, "let's not bother going one for you, one for me. Just pick the pile you want." It was like the old-fashioned way of dividing cake. One child cuts, the other child chooses. After Mr. Errico swept one pile over toward his side of the table, Warren counted out the other and found $25 in his pile. That was enough to buy another pinball machine. Pretty soon, seven or eight of Mr. Wilson's pinball machines were sitting in barbershops around town. Warren had discovered the miracle of capital, money that works for its owner, as if it had a job of its own. You had to get along with the barbers. That was crucial. I mean, these guys could all go buy these machines for $25 themselves, so we would always convince them that it took someone with a 400 IQ to repair pinball machines. Now, there were some pretty unsavory characters in the pinball business, and they all hung out at a place called Silent Sales. That was our hunting ground. Silent Sales was in the 900 block of D Street, right near the Gaiety Burlesque House on the seedy side of downtown. These characters at Silent Sales were amused by us, sort of. Danley and I would go down there, and we'd look at these machines and buy whatever we could for $25. New machines cost about $300. I used to subscribe to Billboard magazine in those days to keep track of what was going on in pinball machines. The guys at Silent Sales taught us some things. There were some illegal slot machines around, and they showed us how to pour beer into them to make a 50-cent piece get stuck in the mechanism, and you could just keep pulling the handle until it paid. They showed us how to disable the electric cutoff for the coin-operated soda machines at the movie theaters, so if you stuck a nickel in, then immediately pulled the plug, you could empty the whole machine. These guys would explain all this stuff to us, and we'd just eat it up. My dad probably suspected the kind of characters we were hanging out with, but he always felt I'd turn out okay. Warren and Don were already making good money with single pinball machines and barbershops, but then they found a gold mine. Our home run of all time was down near Griffith Stadium, which is the old baseball park. In the middle of Washington's worst slums, they found a seven-chair black barbershop. There were a lot of dudes down there. After we put a pinball machine in, we would come back to collect, and these guys had drilled holes in the bottom of the machine and rigged the tilt mechanism. It was a real contest of wills, but that was our motherlode, our best location by far. The guys who played at these barbershops were constantly imploring us to adjust the tilt mechanism so you could shove the machine harder without making it tilt. Listen, we were not judgmental about our customers. If anything, they were probably trying to pick up more ideas like the scams the guys at Silent Sales had taught them and those they were inventing on their own. One time we were down in Danley's basement playing with my coin collection. To make collecting on the paper route more interesting, I used to collect different kinds of coins. So I had these Whitman coin boards with slots for the coins. I said to Don, "It looks to me like we could take these coin boards and use them as molds for casting slugs." Danley was the brains of the operation, and so, sure enough, he learned how to pour these molds for casting slugs, and I supplied the coin boards. We would try to use the slugs for vending machines, for soda pop, and things like that. Our basic formula was to have our income in currency and our outgo in slugs. One time, Danley's father came down in the basement and said, "What are you boys doing?" We were pouring metal into these things, and it was, "We're doing this experiment for school, Dad." We were always doing experiments for school. At school, however, Warren mostly liked to talk about his businesses, not his scams, and by the spring semester, near the end of high school, his racketeering had turned him and Don into a minor legend around Woodrow Wilson. Everybody knew we had the pinball machine business, and everybody kind of knew we were raking it in. We probably exaggerated, too, when we told them, and so people wanted in on it. It was like stocks. One of them was a boy named Bob Curlin, an intense kid who played on the golf team with Warren. He and Don weren't open to letting anyone in on their pinball business, but they did have a plan for using Curlin for their newest venture. We had given up stealing the golf balls from Sears, but we got this idea that we were going to retrieve lost golf balls from the lakes on golf courses around Washington. And now we saw a position for Curlin, because neither one of us wanted to retrieve the golf balls. They created an elaborate scenario for how Curlin would do this. It bordered on an evil prank, but school was out in a couple of months, so what the hell? We went down again to 9th and D, where the Army Surplus Store was located, right by Silent Sales, and bought a gas mask. And then we got this garden hose, and we hooked them up and tested this thing in a bathtub by putting our faces in 3 inches of water. Doing what he called his Tom Sawyer routine, Warren said to Curlin, "This is your chance. We're going to deal you in. We told him that we would go out at 4 in the morning to some golf course in Virginia, and that he would wear the gas mask in the lake and retrieve the balls, and we'd split the money 3 ways. Curlin said, "How do I stay down at the bottom?" And I said, "Oh, I've got that all worked out. What we will do is you'll strip, and you'll be nude, but you'll wear my Washington Post newspaper bag, and we'll put barbell plates in the newspaper bag so that you'll stay on the bottom." So we went out to this golf course, and all the way Curlin was expressing some doubt. And Danley and I said, "Have we ever failed? I mean, you're looking at a couple of guys. If you want to quit now, okay, but, you know, you're not in any future deals." So we got out there at the crack of dawn. Curlin was stripped, and we were dressed warmly. He was totally nude with a Washington Post newspaper bag and all of these barbell plates, and he started wading into the lake. Of course, he didn't know if he was stepping on snakes or golf balls or whatever. And then he got down, and when he tugged on the rope, we pulled him back up. He said, "I can't see anything." We said, "Don't worry about seeing anything. Just grope around." And he started to go back down. But before his head went under, this truck came over the rise, carrying the guy that's going to fill up sand traps in the morning. He saw us and drove up, saying, "What are you kids doing?" Danley and I were thinking fast. "We're conducting an experiment for our high school physics class, sir." Curlin was nodding the whole time, so we had to get him out of the pond. The whole thing blew up on us. Whatever happened to poor Curlin, and however nude he actually was, a watered-down version of this story got around. It would be the last great Tom Sawyering of Warren's high school career. By now, however, he had made a small fortune. A glistening $5,000 heap, sticky with the newsprint from throwing more than 500,000 newspapers. Newsprint snowflakes made up more than half his snowball. Rich as he was, however, Warren meant to keep that snowball rolling. Thanks to inflation, a 16-year-old with a similar pile as of 2007 would have roughly $53,000. Chapter 13. The Rules of the Racetrack. Omaha and Washington, D.C., 1940s. Warren's Dale Carnegie tests of behavior were handicapping, a mathematical experiment on human nature. The data he collected gave him the odds that Carnegie was right. This way of thinking was an extension of his childhood hobby of calculating the odds on the life expectancies of hymn composers. But his interest in longevity was no mere abstraction. Ernest Buffett, to whom Warren was extremely attached, had died in September 1946 at age 69, while the family was in Omaha campaigning for Howard's third term. Warren was 16. Of his 4 grandparents, only Stella, age 73, remained alive, confined in the Norfolk State Hospital. Long before Ernest's death, Warren had been preoccupied with his own lifespan. These latest family events did nothing to ease his mind about either longevity or insanity. Warren's passion for handicapping, however, extended to many other subjects, and in an embryonic form had started much earlier, well before he even knew the meaning of the term, back when he was a little kid with marbles and license plates and bottle caps and a fingerprint kit for nuns. The art of handicapping is based on information. The key was having more information than the other guy, then analyzing it right and using it rationally. Warren had first put this into practical use as a child down at the Exarban racetrack when his friend Bob Russell's mother introduced the boys to the world of peri-mutual betting. Warren and Russ were too young to wager, but they quickly figured out how to make a buck. Amid the cigarette butts, beer slops, old programs, and hot dog remnants and the grime and sawdust of the Exarban floorboards, were thousands of discarded tickets, peeping out like mushrooms on the forest floor. The boys turned themselves into truffle hounds. They call that stooping. At the start of the racing season, you get all these people who'd never seen a race except in the movies, and they'd think that if your horse came in second or third, you didn't get paid, because all the emphasis is on the winner. So they'd throw away place and show tickets. The other time you would hit it big was when there was a disputed race. That little light would go on that said contested or protest. By that time, some people had thrown away their tickets. Meanwhile, we were just gobbling them up. We wouldn't even look at them when we were working. At night, we'd go through them. It was awful. People would spit on the floor, but we had great fun. If I found any winning tickets, my Aunt Alice, who didn't care anything at all about races, would cash them in for us, because they wouldn't cash them for kids. Warren wanted to go to the races all the time. When Mrs. Russell wasn't taking him, "My dad would never go to the races," says Buffett. He did not believe in the races. Instead, his parents let his great-uncle Frank, the oddball of the family, take him. Frank had long ago reconciled with Ernest and had eventually married a woman whom the family referred to as the gold digger. He had no particular interest in the horses, but he took Warren to Exarban because his great-nephew wanted to go. At Exarban, Warren had learned something about how to read the tip sheet, and it opened up a whole new world. Handicapping horses combined two things he was very, very good at: collecting information and math. It was not unlike counting cards at blackjack, except that the winning hand had four legs and ran around a track. Soon, he and Russ knew enough to put out their own tip sheet, the cannily named Stable Boy Selections. We got away with it for a while. They weren't the hottest sellers in the world. I mean, a couple of little kids selling this thing we typed up in my basement on an old Royal typewriter. The limiting factor was carbons in those days. You could probably only get in five or so carbons. But I got on the Royal, and Bob Russell and I doped out the horses, and then we typed up this thing. We were in the track yelling, "Get your Stable Boy Selections!" But the blue sheet was the number one tip sheet, and the racetrack was getting a commission on it. The blue sheet sold for a little more. At 25 cents, we were a cut-rate product. They shut down the Stable Boy Selections fast, because they were getting a cut on everything sold in the place, except for us. When the Buffetts moved to Washington, D.C., the only plus for Warren was the chance to upgrade his handicapping skills. The one thing I knew about Congress was that congressmen had access to the Library of Congress, and that the Library of Congress had everything that had ever been written. So when I got to Washington, I said, "Pop, there's just one thing I want. I want you to ask the Library of Congress for every book they have on horse handicapping." And my dad said, "Well, don't you think they're going to think it's a little strange if the first thing a new congressman asks for is all the books on horse handicapping?" I said, "Pop, who was out there at the county fair stumping for your election? Who was down there at the packing houses ready to get the cops if something happened?" I said, "And if you're coming up for re-election in 2 more years, you're going to need me. So this is payoff time." And he got me hundreds of books on horse handicapping. Then what I would do is read all these books. I sent away to a place in Chicago on North Clark Street where you could get old racing forms, months of them, for very little. They were old, so who wanted them? I would go through them, using my handicapping techniques to handicap one day and see the next day how it worked out. I ran tests of my handicapping ability day after day, all these different systems I had in my mind. There are two kinds of handicappers. There are speed handicappers and class handicappers. Speed handicappers figure out the horse with the best times in the past. The fastest horse will win. Class handicappers feel that the horse that's run against $10,000 horses and done well, and is now running against the $5,000 horses, will beat them, because, they say, the horse runs just fast enough to win. In horse racing, it pays to understand both types of handicapping, but back then I was basically a speed guy. I was a quantitative guy to start with. As he tested, thought, and observed, Warren discovered the rules of the racetrack. Number one, nobody ever goes home after the first race. Number two, you don't have to make it back the way you lost it. The racetrack counts on people to keep betting until they lose. Couldn't a good handicapper turn these rules around and win? The market is a racetrack, too, but I was not developing elaborate theories in those days. I was just a little kid. Betting in Washington was ubiquitous. I would go down to my dad's office fairly often, and there was actually a bookie in what was then called the Old House Office Building. You could go to the elevator shaft and yell, "Sammy," or something like that, and this kid would come up and take bets. Now, I used to do a little bookmaking, too, for guys who wanted to bet on the Preakness or something like that. That's the end of the game I liked, the 15% take with no risk. My dad, you know, was struggling somewhat to keep this under control. He was amused by it to some extent, but he could also see how it could veer off in the wrong direction. During summer vacations, Warren returned to Omaha and went stooping at the Exarban track, this time with his friend Stu Erickson. Back in Washington, he found a new friend to go to the racetrack with, someone who could advance his handicapping skills. Bob Dwyer, his high school golf coach, a pot-bellied, enterprising young man, made far more than his teacher's stipend by selling life insurance and ice chests and other things during the summer when school was out. The other members of the golf team viewed Dwyer as tough and crusty, but he took a shine to Warren, who had a way about him and played enthusiastically despite his glasses always fogging up. One day, Warren asked Dwyer to take him to the races. His coach said he needed permission. The next morning, Dwyer says, bright and early, he came prancing in with a note from his mother saying it was all right to go to the races. So Dwyer wrote Warren some phony excuse to get out of class, and then they took the Chesapeake in Ohio from Silver Spring, Maryland, over to the racetrack in Charleston, West Virginia. Going to the races with a teacher polished Warren's sophistication about handicapping. Dwyer taught Warren advanced skills in reading the most important tip sheet, the Daily Racing Form. I'd get the Daily Racing Form ahead of time and figure out the probability of each horse winning the race. Then I would compare those percentages to the odds. But I wouldn't look at the odds first, to avoid prejudicing myself. Sometimes you would find a horse where the odds were way, way off from the actual probability. You figure the horse has a 10% chance of winning, but it's going off at 15-1. That is, the horse would pay out as if its odds of winning were only 6.7%. Thus, if it won, the payout would be 50% bigger than the horse's track record suggested should occur. A handicapper would take this bet even on the worst horse in the field, because the expected payout is so high compared to the odds. This is an overlay. The less sophisticated the track, the better. You have people betting on the jockey's colors, and you have them betting on their birthdays, you have them betting on the horse's names. And the trick, of course, is to be in a group where practically no one is analytical, and you have a lot of data. So I would study the forms like crazy when I was a kid. One grade behind Warren at Woodrow Wilson, but slightly older, Bill Gray went to a few horse races with him. He was very sharp with numbers, very talkative, very outgoing. We would discuss baseball, batting averages, sports. He knew which horses he was going to pick the minute he got off the train. He would go down to the track and say, well, this horse is too much weight, or this horse, where he's come in the last few races has not been good enough, or his times are not good enough. He knew how to judge the horses. Warren made $6 to $10 bets, sometimes on the nose. Betting on the nose is betting to win. He only bet big if the odds looked good, but he had a way of risking some of his hard-earned paper route money on the right horse. He might change his mind as the different races came forward, says Gray, but for a 16-year-old, that's not so common, you know? Then one time, Warren went to Charleston by himself, and he lost in the first race, but he didn't go home. He kept on betting, and he kept on losing, until he had lost more than $175, and his pockets were stripped nearly bare. I came back, I went to the hot shop, and I treated myself to the biggest thing they offered, a giant fudge sundae or something. And there went all the rest of my money. While I ate, I figured out how many newspapers I had to deliver to make up what I had lost. I was going to have to work more than a week to make back the money, and I'd done it for dumb reasons. You're not supposed to bet every race. I'd committed the worst sin, which is that you get behind and you think you've got to break even that day. The first rule is that nobody goes home after the first race, and the second rule is that you don't have to make it back the way you lost it. That is so fundamental, you know? Did he realize that he'd made an emotional decision? Oh, yeah. Oh, I was sick. It was the last time I ever did anything like that. Chapter 14. The Elephant. Philadelphia. 1947 to 1949. Warren graduated 16th out of 350 in his high school class, putting future stockbroker under his picture in the yearbook. The first thing he and Danley did with their freedom was to go in together and buy a used hearse. Warren parked the hearse in front of the house and used it to take a girl out on a date. When Howard came home later, he asked, "Who put that hearse out here?" Then Lila said one of the neighbors was gravely ill and she was not having a hearse in front of the house. That was the end of the hearse. While he and Don were selling the hearse, Warren gave up his paper routes and got a summer job as a relief circulation manager for the Times Herald, moving up in the world. Whenever he had to substitute for his paper carriers, he rose at 4 a.m. and delivered the papers from a little Ford coupe he borrowed from David Brown, a young man from Fredericksburg who had a crush on Doris and who had gone into the Navy. Standing on the running board of the car with the door open, he coasted at about 15 miles an hour, one hand reaching inside the car to hold on to the wheel, the other hand grabbing the papers and pitching them onto the subscribers' lawns. He rationalized that at such an early hour of the morning, nothing too terrible was likely to result from driving the car that way. Afterward, he stopped by the Tottle House at 4:45 a.m. to treat himself to a double order of hash browns with paprika for breakfast. Then he went on to his second job, distributing papers at Georgetown University Hospital. "I had to give the priests and nuns about a half a dozen papers free, which always irritated me to no end. I thought they weren't supposed to be interested in secular things, but this was part of the deal. And then I went room by room, ward by ward. After they had the baby, the women in the obstetrics ward would see me come in and say, 'Oh, Warren, I'm going to give you something more valuable than a cash tip. I'm going to tell you when my baby was born and how much it weighed. 8:31 a.m., 6 pounds and 11 ounces.' The baby's birth times and weights were meant for betting on the policy racket, the numbers game in Washington. Warren ground his teeth whenever he got useless information instead of a cash tip. As a handicapper, he would never have played the policy racket. The odds were terrible. The policy racket paid off 600-1, and the guy that was your runner got 10% of it. So you have a 540-1 payoff on what was a 1,000-1 shot, basically. People made penny bets and dime bets. If you put a penny up, you might win $5.40 net, and everybody in town played. Some of my newspaper delivery customers used to ask me, 'Do you run policy numbers?' I never did. My dad would not have approved if I'd become a policy runner." He was already a good enough odds maker to work in Vegas, but he probably would not have bet on the next thing his father did. Howard Buffett voted for a bill that actually passed, joining 330 other congressmen who made the Taft-Hartley Act law over President Truman's veto. One of the most controversial pieces of legislation ever enacted in the United States, the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act severely restricted the tactics used by labor unions. It made it illegal for them to support one another through secondary strikes and authorized U.S. presidents to declare a national emergency and force striking workers back to work. It was referred to as a slave labor bill. Omaha was, of course, a union town, but it would never have occurred to Howard to vote according to his constituents' preferences. He always voted his principles. So when the Buffetts went home to Omaha for a visit during the summer, and Warren went to a hometown baseball game with his father, he saw just how unpopular Howard had become among the blue-collar voters. They introduced the dignitaries in between the doubleheader, and he stood up and everybody in the place started booing. He just stood there and didn't say anything. He could handle things like that, but you just can't imagine the effect that has on a kid. Even the mildest forms of confrontation terrified him, but soon he would be standing on his own, out from under his father's wing. At almost 17, Warren was barely a kid. 1 year older and a few years earlier, he might have been fighting in the war. Instead of the military, in the fall, he was starting college. The Buffetts had long taken for granted that Warren would attend the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Business School. Wharton was the nation's most important undergraduate business college, and Penn, the brainchild of Benjamin Franklin, creator of aphorisms like, "He that goes a-borrowin' goes a-sorrowin'," Time is money, and a penny saved is a penny earned. In theory, Penn and Warren, who had the energy of two people and hustled like a stevedore while other kids played, were a perfect fit. However, Warren would have just as soon skipped the whole thing. What was the point? He asked himself. I knew what I wanted to do. I was making enough money to live on. College was only going to slow me down. But he would never have defied his father on something so important, so he acquiesced. Knowing their son's immaturity, the Buffetts arranged a roommate for him who was the son of some friends from Omaha. 5 years older, Chuck Peterson had just returned from 18-month service in the war. He was a handsome young man about town, dating a different girl every night, and drinking. Naively, the Petersons supposed that Warren might settle Chuck down, while the Buffetts reckoned that an older boy might help Warren adjust to college. In the fall of 1947, the entire family piled into the car and drove Warren to Philadelphia, where they deposited him and his raccoon coat in a little dormitory suite with a shared bathroom. Chuck had already moved in, but was out on a date somewhere. As the Buffetts drove away to return to Washington, they left their son at a campus filled with people much like Chuck. An army of World War II veterans marched across College Green and filled the quad, the centers of Penn University life. Their worldliness widened by years the gap Warren had felt between himself and his classmates ever since moving to Washington. On an organized, busy social campus, his baggy t-shirts and worn tennis shoes stood out among the purposeful men dressed in sports coats and polished Oxfords. Penn was a football powerhouse. Its fall social life revolved around football dates, followed by fraternity parties. Warren loved sports, but the social requirements were beyond him. He was used to spending much of his time honing ideas, counting his money, organizing his collections, and playing music in the privacy of his room. At Penn, his solitude battered by the 1,600 flirting, necking, jitterbugging, keg-tapping, football-tossing members of the class of 1951, he was a butterfly in a beehive. The bees reacted much as expected to the butterfly that had flown into their midst. Chuck retained his military tidiness and the habit of constantly polishing his shoes. When he met his new roommate, Warren's disgraceful wardrobe shocked him. He soon discovered that the way Warren dressed symptomized something else. Just as Lila had waited hand and foot on Howard and did all the work around the house, Warren had never been taught the most basic ways of taking care of himself. Chuck stayed out late socializing as usual his first evening after they met. The next morning, he woke late to find the bathroom in a mess and his new roommate gone to early classes. When he saw Warren that evening, he said, "Clean up after yourself, will you?" "Okay, Chazzo," Warren said. "I came in this morning and you left a razor lying at the bottom of the sink," Chuck went on. "You left soap all over the sink, the towels were on the floor, and it's sloppier than hell. I like things neat." Warren appeared to agree. "Okay, Chazzo. Okay, Chazzo," he said. The next morning, when Chuck got up, he stepped through sodden towels on the bathroom floor to find tiny damp hairs covering the sink and a brand new, soaking wet electric razor lying in the basin, tethered to the outlet in the wall by its cord. "Warren, look it," said Chuck that evening. "Unplug the damn thing. Somebody's going to get electrocuted. I'm not going to pick it up out of the sink every morning. You're driving me nuts with your sloppiness." "Okay, okay, fine, Chazzo," said Warren. The next day was exactly as before, the razor lying in the sink. Chuck realized that his words were bouncing off Warren's head. He lost his temper and decided to take action. He unplugged the razor, filled the sink with water, and threw the razor in. The following morning, Warren had bought a new razor, plugged it in, and left the bathroom in the same state as before. Chazzo gave up. He was living in a pigsty with a hyperactive teenager who hopped around in constant motion, drumming his hands, beating them on every nearby surface. Warren was obsessed with Al Jolson and played Jolson records day and night. He sang over and over, imitating Jolson, Mammy, my little mammy, I'd walk a million miles for one of your smiles, my mammy. Chuck needed to study, and he could not hear himself think inside the suite. Warren, on the other hand, had plenty of time to sing. He hadn't bought a lot of textbooks, but he had read the ones he bought at the beginning of the semester, before classes started, the way someone else might flip through a Life magazine. Then he threw them aside and never opened them again. This left him all night long to sing Mammy, if he felt like it. Chuck thought he was going mad. Warren knew he was immature, but he couldn't help it. I probably wouldn't have fit in very well any place at that time. I was still out of sync with the world. But I was also younger than anybody else, and, on top of that, I was young for my age in many ways. I really didn't fit in socially. Chuck's social life, on the other hand, was in full swing. He had pledged Alpha Tau Omega. Warren had little interest in Greek life, but pledged his father's fraternity, Alpha Sigma Phi. It was not a jock house, nor particularly brutal, but the rituals of pledging turned him red-faced. The secret motto of Alpha Sig was Zeal, Humility, Courage. Warren had plenty of the first two, but courage was his Achilles' heel. When the pledges were sent to Wanamaker's to buy extra-large women's panties and brassieres, he circled the underwear department for a long time before facing the snickering co-ed salesgirls. That fall, Lila and Doris struggled to describe Warren's crew-cut, slightly buck-toothed appearance truthfully on a radio show in Washington called Coffee with Congress. Host, incidentally, is Warren good-looking? Lila, he was good-looking as a small child. He's just boyish. I wouldn't call him good-looking, but he's not poor-looking either. Host, he's handsome-looking. Lila, no, not handsome, just friendly. Host, let's take the girl's angle. Is he a cute boy? Doris, diplomatically, I think he has a rugged sort of look. Despite the drumming and the mammy singing, Chuck came to be fond of Warren, viewing him as a sort of goofy kid brother, although he still could not believe his roommate continued to wear beat-up Keds throughout the winter, and even when dressed up was likely to wear one black shoe and one brown shoe without noticing. Like many people who met Warren, Chuck began to feel the urge to take care of him. They had lunch together at the student union a couple of times a week. Warren always ordered the same thing: a minute steak, hash browns, and a Pepsi. Then he discovered chocolate sundaes topped with malted milk powder and had those every day, too. One day after lunch, Chuck took Warren over to the new ping-pong table that had just been installed in the student union. After 4 years in Washington, Warren was so rusty that Chuck got the impression he had never played ping-pong. In the first couple of games, Warren could just about return Chuck's serve. Chuck won easily. Within a day or two, however, Warren played like a demon. The first thing every morning, he got up, went straight over to the student union, found a hapless victim, and slaughtered him at the ping-pong table. Before long, he was playing ping-pong 3 or 4 hours at a stretch every afternoon. Chuck could no longer hold his own. "I was his first victim at Penn," he recalls. But ping-pong kept Warren out of the suite and away from the record player while Chuck was studying. Ping-pong, however, did not fulfill Penn's physical education requirement. Rowing and sculling on the Schuylkill River were two of Penn's most popular sports. Gaily painted boathouses belonging to the school's many rowing clubs lined the riverbanks. Warren went out for the 150-pound freshman crew with the Vesper Boat Club. He rowed on a team of 8 oarsmen guided by a coxswain. Rowing was repetitious and rhythmic, like weightlifting, basketball, golf, ping-pong, and his game of bolo, all activities that Warren enjoyed. But it was a team sport. Warren liked to shoot a basketball in his driveway because you could practice alone. He had never succeeded at team sports or learned to dance with a partner. He had been the leader of every stunt or business venture in which he had ever been involved. He couldn't play the part of the echo. It was miserable. The thing about crew is you can't coast or fake it. You have to put your oar in the water at exactly the same time as everybody else. You can be unbelievably tired, but you have to match the pace, and it must be done in unison. It's an incredibly grueling sport. He came back to the dorm every afternoon, sweating, head bowed, hands bloodied and blistered, and dropped crew as soon as he could. Warren was looking for a different kind of team. He wanted Chuck to sell used golf balls with him, but Chuck was too busy trying to study and maintain his social life. Warren also suggested that Chuck join him in a pinball business. He didn't need Chuck's money or labor, and it wasn't even clear what Chuck's role would be. But Warren, a one-man bandwagon, wanted someone to whom he could talk about his businesses, always and endlessly. If Chuck became a partner, it would make him part of Warren's world. He had always been good at this Tom Sawyering, but for once, he failed with Chuck. Still, he wanted Chuck as a friend as well as a business partner. He invited Chuck to visit him in Washington. Lila was astonished when Chuck ate everything she offered him, even oatmeal. "Warren won't eat anything," she said. "He won't eat this, he won't eat that. He always makes me fix something special for him." Chuck was amused to find that Warren had his mother so well trained. To Chuck, Warren seemed an odd mix of immature kid and brilliant prodigy. In many of his classes, he simply memorized what the professor said, not needing to look at a textbook. He flaunted obnoxious feats of memory by quoting page numbers and passages back in class and correcting his teachers on their text citations. "You forgot the comma," he said to one. In an accounting course, the proctors had not even finished passing out the exam papers to the 200-odd students when Warren, showing off, stood up and turned in his paper. He was done. Chuck, sitting on the other side of the room, was frustrated. Wharton was no picnic. A quarter of the class would flunk out. But Warren cruised through with no apparent effort, leaving him as much time as he wanted to drum his hands and sing, "Mammy, My Little Mammy," all night long. Chuck liked Warren well enough, but it all finally got to him. "He moved out on me. One morning I woke up and Chuck was gone." At term's end that summer, Warren, who would never have thought he'd actually be glad to return to Washington, went home. Lila was in Omaha helping Howard campaign for re-election, so the Buffett kids, who had rarely gotten any relief from their parents' austere regimen, experienced a glorious summer of freedom. Bertie was a camp counselor. Doris had a job at Garfinkel's, where she was shocked that the store asked your religion on the job application, and blacks could only shop on the first floor, where no clothing was sold. Washington was then the most segregated city in the United States. Blacks could not work as streetcar conductors or motormen or anything other than the most menial jobs. They could not enter the YMCA, eat in most restaurants, rent hotel rooms, or buy theater tickets. Dark-skinned diplomats had to be chaperoned, embarrassed, and scandalized by a provincialism like no place else in the world. "I would rather be an untouchable in the Hindu caste system than a Negro in Washington," one foreign visitor said. The Washington Post, referred to by some right-wingers as the uptown communist sheet, had been on a crusade about racism for some time, and President Truman had desegregated the military and was pushing for civil rights reforms. But change was slow. Warren, who did not read the Liberal Post, paid little attention to Washington's racism. He was both unaware and immature, too absorbed in his own insecurity, his stunts, and his businesses. He returned that summer to his duties as relief circulation manager for the conservative Times Herald. He still had the borrowed Ford and once again used it to deliver papers if he had to fill in for one of his paper boys, using the running board technique he had perfected earlier. He also reunited with his pal Don Danley. They thought about buying a fire engine together as their latest stunt, but instead found a 1928 Springfield Rolls-Royce Phantom I Brewster Coupe for $350 in a junkyard in Baltimore. It was gray, weighed more than a Lincoln Continental, and was adorned with little bud vases. The car had two sets of instruments, so the lady in back, the employer, could see how fast the chauffeur was driving. The starter was broken, so Don and Warren took turns cranking it until it finally started up. Then they drove it the 50 miles or so back to Washington. It belched smoke, leaked oil, and lacked taillights and license plates, But when they were stopped by a cop, Warren kept talking and talking and talking until he wiggled their way out of a ticket. They put the rolls in the garage underneath the Buffett house and started the motor up. The house immediately filled with acrid smoke, so they pulled it back out and up the steep driveway onto the street. They worked on it Saturday after Saturday. Danley did all the work, according to Doris, tinkering with the pipes and doing the welding, and Warren watched admiringly and encouraged it along. When they decided to paint the car, Don and his girlfriend, Norma Thurston, bought something called a paddo paint, which smeared on the color with a sponge. They painted the car dark blue. It looked really good to them. Naturally, word had gotten around, so they rented it out, $35 a pop. Then Warren had an idea for a stunt. He wanted to be seen in the car. Danley dressed up like a chauffeur, Warren put on the raccoon coat, and the two cranked and cranked to start the car, then drove downtown with platinum blonde Norma. As Danley lunged about under the hood, pretending to fix the motor, Warren directed him with a cane, and Norma draped herself over the hood like a movie star. "It was Warren's idea," says Norma. "He was the more theatrical one. We were going to see how many people would look at us." Norma knew that Warren had never really dated in high school and needed help with girls, so she set him up with her cousin, Bobby Worley. They dated chastely that summer, going to movies and playing bridge, Warren barraging her with an endless series of brain teasers and riddles. When fall came, he left Bobby behind and returned to Penn as an 18-year-old sophomore. He now had two roommates, his fraternity brother, Clyde Rygard, and a freshman who was assigned to them, George Aceman. The year before, he had Tom Sawyered Clyde into acting as the front man for a business venture that went nowhere, but during their short-lived partnership, the two had become friends. Warren had not changed much since his freshman year, but he had much more in common with Clyde than he had with Chuck Peterson. Clyde was amused by Warren's tennis shoes and T-shirts and dirty khaki pants, and he took it in stride when Warren needled and taunted him about his grades. "While he didn't make me any smarter," says Rygard, "he did make me use what I had more efficiently." Indeed, Warren was a master at using what he had efficiently, his own time especially. He rose early in the morning, ate chicken salad at the dorm for breakfast, then headed off to classes. After sleepwalking through his freshman year, he had finally found one class he liked, Professor Hockenberry's Industry 101, which discussed different industries and the nuts and bolts of running a business. "It was textiles, it was steel, it was petroleum. I can still remember that book. I got a lot of stuff from it. I can remember talking about the laws of capture in petroleum and the Bessemer processes in steel. I devoured that book. That was really interesting to me." But his sweet mate, Harry Beja, a grind who sweated through Hockenberry's class alongside Warren, resented the way he tobogganed ahead effortlessly. It was the same in business law, taught by Professor Cataldo, who had very close to a photographic mind. He would quote cases at length. "I can still remember Hadley versus Baxendale and Kemble versus Farron, so I would do the same thing back to him on the exams, which entertained him to no end. I would quote from his stuff and answering questions, whether applicable or not, and he just ate it up." Helped by his prodigious memory, Warren was free to do as he pleased for much of the day. At lunchtime, he dropped by the Alpha Sig House, an old three-story mansion with a spiral staircase, where Kelson, the black houseman, cooked, cleaned, and, in his white jacket, gave the place a degree of dignity. A bridge game went on 24 hours a day in a corner alcove, and Warren would sit down and play a few hands. His taste for practical jokes continued unabated. He occasionally enlisted one of his fraternity brothers, Lenny Farina, to pose for attention-getting photographs out in the street while he pretended to pick Lenny's pocket or shine his shoes. Meanwhile, in a scam reminiscent of sending poor old Curlin into a water trap naked wearing a gas mask, he and Clyde had told their third roommate, George, that he looked run down and puny and would never attract girls unless he developed muscles. They finally maneuvered George into buying himself some barbells, and then we used to bang these barbells up and down while Harry Beja was studying down below. We had great fun taunting him by banging these barbells on the floor. By college, however, the evidence had become convincing. Warren had begun to give up on the idea of becoming a strongman. After a while, I decided my bones were wrong. My clavicles were not long enough. It's your clavicles that determine how broad-shouldered you'll be, and you can't do much about your clavicles. That's why I got disgusted and eventually quit. I decided that if I was going to have girl-like muscles anyway, then to hell with it.